name is Irene Kurka and I welcome you to my podcast Neue Musik Leben. I have studied classical singing, but now I'm singing lots of contemporary and experimental music. And if you want to get in touch with me, please look at my website www.irenekurka. I will also put this into the show notes for you. In this podcast, I talk about themes all around contemporary music. I share with you inside knowledge, behind the scenes, and I bring you the human beings out of the new music world closer. I'm always very touched when you write me and I get emails from all over the world, and that really motivates me to keep going. I'm also cooperating with NMZ, and this is one of the biggest music paper in Germany. This is a podcast that usually is in German, but I have now already 10 episodes in English, all with great interviews. And this is now the anniversary episode. I'm having this podcast now for 2 years. I started on the 10th of April in 2018. And I'm very glad that you're here with me, even though I know that we all are going through a big crisis and challenge in this time because of the coronavirus. And I still hope that this episode might inspire you or cheer you up. I have a great guest for you, David Moss. He's an amazing vocalist and improviser, and he will tell you all about his work. And yeah, he started out as a percussionist and then he became a singer. And I really find the whole story and David very, very interesting, inspiring. So enjoy the interview with David Moss. Hello, David Moss.
Hey, Irene.
I'm very happy to be here with you in Berlin.
Great to meet.
And let's dive right into it. My first question for you is, how did you find your way into new and experimental music?
I started as a drummer from the jazz world. My father was a drummer as a hobby in Dixieland music, and I found my love for drumming through his love for drumming. Also, my parents sang a lot, and I thought it was strange to be singing, but it stayed in my mind as an example of pleasure. They got a lot of pleasure from singing, and so these ideas of drumming and pleasure and singing mixed together in me when I was young. And then I was very strongly affected by the most experimental last music of John Coltrane, which for me was an open-ended exploration and an adventure into sound, timeless. Well, there was time in it, but it moved into a timeless dimension of sound exploration with emotion together with it. So in some way it was linked to, for me, a vocal sound, although it was saxophone, it was linked in some way to the emotional voice I was feeling as I was 19, 20 years old. And then I wanted to play the drums. I wanted to play music with in some professional system of, so shall we say, free jazz. And I met by chance a composer, trumpet player who was known at the time. His name was Bill Dixon, black composer, trumpet player who played with Archie Shepp and Cecil Taylor and all these guys. And he needed a drummer at that moment. And I was available and he auditioned me and he said, okay, you can be my drummer and I'll teach you what to do. I'll give you composition lessons in exchange for being my drummer. This is a wonderful thought that I could play drums and also have some way in to composition as a performer, as a musician. So I worked with this man, Bill Dixon, for several years as his drummer and got a lot of information from him about melody and movement of tones and transitions and layering, a lot of beautiful compositional information. But at the same time, my drumming was getting more and more experimental and complex, and he didn't approve of that. He wanted me to stay in a certain category of drummers which jazz, free jazz, described. And as I moved away from it, I came into conflict with my first guru, Bill. And at some point we had to split up. And I basically said, I have to leave you because I found a way I want to go. And okay, we split apart, friendly enough, and I had found something, a direction I wanted to move in, and it involved experimenting very strongly with what percussion could do that was not simply drumming. What sounds I could bring in, what objects I could bring in, what changes I could make to the idea of a drum set, to the idea of a cymbal, how I could make them multi-purpose, and how I could layer them and make them denser and thicker and weirder and stranger and unexpected, surprising. At the same time, developing my own virtuosity, that was always a point for me to develop my skills, my hands, my feet, my ideas, so I could really utilize the new territory I was discovering. And at a very interesting point, this is the point of when the voice came back into my life. I was 22, and I was playing the drums so hard and so intense and so fast, so furious, that I stopped breathing. I forgot to breathe. I was holding my breath, you know? And this was actually a very, very bad contradiction.
Yes.
If you hold your breath long enough, you have no oxygen. And then what happened to me was holding my breath and pushing my diaphragm, so pushing down hard so I could force my hands to like move faster and further. And that was great for 20, 30 seconds. And then my hands would tingle and I would have no more oxygen, and the sticks would fly out of my hands at some point by accident. When I hit something wrong, boom, and there I was, stickless, defeated, trying to be better, but ending up making it worse. Mm-hmm. And so to make a long story short, I found a way to keep breathing, which was to make a sound.
Ah.
Yeah, so I very, very softly to myself just went, completely subterranean. Nobody could hear it, only I knew I was breathing. So I would play the drums as fast as possible, but I would keep the flow of air going. And this was a gigantic help for me. It was really great, you know? And I was breathing, the oxygen was going, I didn't have to push my diaphragm and I could play. And then my mind began to listen to what was happening. And my brain said to me, David, you're doing something interesting here. You're making a sound that's not your drums. Why don't you use it? Why don't you develop it? Mm-hmm. Why don't you work with it, you know, extend it? And that's what I did for the next 10 years. I began to find ways to build my voice into the drums, to make my voice be with the drum, to play as quickly and as sharply and as attack-oriented and as fast-changing as the drums could be with my hands and feet. So two hands, 2 feet, changing all of these sounds, and do it with my voice in unison sometimes contrapoint, you know, contrapunctus sometimes. And then I said, well, if I can do it like my drums, why don't I try to do it differently from my drums? So then I had my voice be the sustain instrument above the sound of the drum. So high melodic or minimally melodic, 2 or 3 notes above the drums, and the drums very fast and very busy underneath. So now I had 2 levels. And then I said, okay, so now I can make 3 levels if I jump back and forth between above the drums, with the drums, above the drums, with the drums. Then what about if I go under the drums? Can I go under the drums and have the drums be the melodic sound? So this opened up 10 years of work for me. And as I did this work, which was natural, I realized that I was doing experimental music. Yes. I never thought of it that way, you know? I was doing the music I loved, you know? But
so for a long time you combined it, the playing,
yes,
the drum and the vocal part.
Yes, I was a drummer. You see, I always thought of myself as a drummer. I never thought of myself as a singer for many years. And the singing was an extra ingredient.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly enough, the singing got stronger and stronger because, I believe, I was tied to a system of virtuosity and style as a drummer. I learned how to play the drums. No one taught me how to sing, which is my advantage and my disadvantage, mm-hmm, at the same time. I taught myself.
So you taught yourself.
I taught myself everything. I had no system that was calling me or forcing me or shaping me. Therefore, there was nothing impossible in my voice. I could try everything. Of course, I was intelligent enough not to hurt myself. And just like with the drums, I didn't put broken glass on the drums, mm-hmm, and, you know, cut my hands open. I understand the feeling of the voice. I learned that as I went along. But for me, the voice was, in a certain way, a beautiful freedom, a beautiful unknown territory that had no boundaries. And the drums had certain boundaries, which I was always trying to push and expand. Mm-hmm. And this is probably, if I look back on it, the reason why I moved more and more into voice. And the drums slowly began to move not into the background or became not my persona anymore. And of course, this was a 25-year development, you mm-hmm. know, of how a person creates their own work, which ended up being experimental or new music for me, my version of it.
And when did you meet then people who would then work with you as a drummer or a singer with contemporary music?
Yeah, after Bill Dixon, I was looking for people. This was around 1974. I started looking for people who were doing something that I could join with. And strangely enough, the first people I found were dancers, not musicians. The musicians that I was around from the jazz world and even from the contemporary music world were not interested in the sounds I was making. They were somehow too raw or too non-genre. They didn't fit for...
But you were still in America at that time?
I was in America. I was in America until 1991, mm-hmm. living there. And in the U.S., I have to say, from my experience, the new music scene was extremely cut off from the rest of the mm-hmm. world in America. And also, they really hurt themselves by cutting themselves off from each other. So there are all these different styles. There was the minimalism, there was the maximalism, there was electronic, there was the free jazz, there was the improv that wasn't jazz, there was a ambient, you know, they were like, absolutely, these categories were incredibly strong, and it was difficult to meet people outside of your own category, you know, who wanted to work with you. And one of the reasons it was like that in America is the development of categories helped people to survive. They could describe themselves, they could get work, mm-hmm. they could earn money mm-hmm. because they were, I play ambient music, I play this music, not, oh, I'm just a musician who makes weird mm-hmm. sounds. We had to describe ourselves. Mm-hmm. We had to accept many people. We had to accept the genre label. Okay, so.
This is how you got into it. And you met then other people in the States also.
I met lots of people in America. And I was eventually, after 5 or 6 years of wandering until 1979, I began to connect to the scene in New York City, which was this what later was called in noise music. So a scene consisting of all outsiders from New York who moved to New York who were looking for colleagues, you know, mm-hmm. looking for a way to show their stuff. So Fred Frith, John Zorn, Ardo Lindsay, Bill Laswell, Bill Frizzell, all these people of this particular scene came into an improvisation world together in the late 70s, early 80s. And this group of people was very interested in really what I was interested in, which was fast-changing, very active, intense sound, manipulated by the mind more than genre. You would change ideas very quickly in your mind. You would not make quotations of other music. You would be really making extreme, rapid, abstract sound. Mm-hmm. And that's what we tried to do at that time. And that was great. Then we had a whole scene. Maybe there were 40 players in New York who were doing this around 1982, mm-hmm. 80, 82. And we made 20 different groups, and each of us played with each other's groups. And we tried to develop each person, like me and Ardo and John Zorn and Fred. We had our own ideas. We had our own directions, but coming together was a way to explode into something new each time. So we really did love to play together.
And how did you come to Germany, and what did change that?
Yeah, so that was now 10 years later. So in the 80s, my world of music could not survive in the U.S. There was no work really for us. Mm. I mean, we could play in New York for $7. I played with an incredible group of people, the most famous guys we ever had developed, and we got $7 each. Mm. You know, that kind of thing. It was New York, okay. And if we went out and played somewhere in Pennsylvania or Philadelphia, we'd get $50 each. You know, you could not survive. Mm-hmm. And many people stopped music because they couldn't survive. So to survive, the European music scene wanted us. But it was strange. They wanted what we were doing. There were people, curators, festival directors, mm-hmm. looking for stuff. Mm-hmm. And they came to New York, and they came to different cities, and they looked for what was happening, what they thought might be interesting. And they found some of us. And I was lucky. I got noticed by some people and brought to Germany. And first time was in, the first time in Germany was 82. And then 83 at the Mirrors Music Festival in Western Germany. And this was the beginning for me of Europe, of European development, because in some way, our scene was a revolutionary moment for some people. We weren't the first ones to make noise, but we were maybe the first ones who did it loud and mm-hmm. and wild in some way, you know? Without politics, without a manifesto, without saying we were the new movement, just mm-hmm. doing it, you know.
Yep.
So that was the beginning, coming from New York into the German and Western European scene in the early 80s. And then it kept on going. I was touring all the time to make my living and to play and to meet people. I was coming 5, 6, 7 times a year, sometimes 10 times a year to Europe to play for 2, 3, 4, 5, 20 gigs and go back to the U.S. And that was life from 1982 till 1990. That was a life, you know, really traveling a lot and meeting everybody, meeting a lot of people, playing with people, meeting people like Heiner Goebbels and other people who became my friends and my colleagues, and developing a kind of a potential network for the future, which then actually, when I moved here, came into really, really big existence, you know.
That's great. What represents good new music for you?
Good new music is, for me, any music that makes me stop and have a moment of, as I say, timelessness. So I'm no longer thinking about where I am or what's going on or what I should be doing. Good new music takes me out of normal life, out of daily life. It can be a kind of music that may not be called new music. Mm-hmm. It can be coming from a different field, but if it takes me out, it means that it's offering some sound vision that I'm not familiar with, and I have to sort of swim in it. Mm-hmm. And this swimming idea is a way to leave your daily consciousness to experience something new and fresh. And so that's, for me, good new music. That's wonderful new music when that happens.
Mm-hmm. And what are the qualities you most appreciate in composers you work with?
Well, any composer who wants to work with me knows my limitations and my abilities and my specialties, you know, what I can do and what I can't do. I'm not a trained singer. I've trained myself. I'm not a classical singer in the sense of my voice has not developed certain ways to hit notes. I can't read notation quickly at all. It takes me a long time to learn a part. I mean, I basically have to memorize a part, you know, to learn it, and I can't see it from the page. So those are my limitations. A composer who wants to work with me, if they accept that, it means certain things. It means a question of time. They have to work with me for a certain amount of time because they can't give me the part 2 weeks before mm-hmm. and expect me to sing it. I can't do it. I tell them, forget about it, you know? And if they want to write microtonal music with a quarter tone or eighth tone or 16th tone variations, I say at the beginning, don't use me. I'm not good for that, you know? I can't do that. However, I can do certain things which a lot of people can't do. I can sing I can improvise very well. I can make surprising moments happen that are not totally notated. I can change my voice very quickly. Mm-hmm. I can go from talking to singing to sound making to noise sounding to text reciting to energy to emotion to neutral in 5 seconds or mm-hmm. 3 seconds or half a second. I have a pretty good falsetto, so I can mm-hmm. sing quite high and quite soft and fairly controlled. I have a good bottom. I have a good low and somewhat dirty, but there it is. So I offer these things to people, and for some composers, that's attractive. And if we meet mm-hmm. in the middle, and we say, oh yes, I want this kind of voice you have, David. I don't want a male baritone. I want your mm-hmm. I want your voice. I said, great. Then I'm excited to work with you because mm-hmm. I can only offer you my voice.
Sure.
You know.
Sure.
And I always say to a composer, leave a little room in your notation. So leave a little, I would say not blank space, but leave a little place where something can happen unexpected. Mm. Because that's one thing I'm really good at, you know, and I can try things and I can offer things to you. And if you like them, if they sound good to you, we can incorporate them. Mm-hmm. I can repeat them. They can be used. And that might add elements that you're happy about. If you don't leave me this space, I won't try, and we'll never know mm-hmm. what could be. So I offer possibility for unknown mm-hmm. unknown sounds to come in that a composer might enjoy, you know. Mm-hmm. And I really like sitting with the composer and the ones I work with and saying, what could we do with this? Like Heiner and Olga Neuwirth and Helmut Oehring, even when I work with Luciano Berio, they give me something and they say, what would you do with this, David? Mm-hmm. Wow! What an incredible honor that is, you know? What would I do with something you give me? That's such a joy, mm-hmm. you know? I'll try. I will sit there and sing for you for an hour and try as much as you let me mm-hmm. and try things. And if you give me this chance mm-hmm, to sit mm-hmm. to this pleasure of singing with mm-hmm. your singing with your music, this is a paradise, and it's something that the world, I believe, is really lacking from mm-hmm. for most singers. This is not a normal experience, you mm-hmm. know. So I love it, and I love that.
Right. We already talked about it a little bit. You still play percussion, mm-hmm. or yeah?
Percussion for me is part of my body. I mm-hmm. mean, the way I sing references the movement of my hands and mm-hmm. around the drums. I'm moving. Mm-hmm. I feel every movement. I feel every turn of my fingers, every surface. Mm-hmm. Drums have surfaces. That's interesting about drums. To hit a drum, you have to touch the surface, yes, yes. right? It's interesting to think about voice that way. If you're touching a surface to make a sound, it means you're bouncing away, some way bouncing away from the surface. It's a surface. It's a very fast reaction. And I find that helpful and gives me ideas as a singer.
So you practice it every day with the
I practice it with my hands, with percussion.
But
with
you don't perform percussion
I don't
anymore.
Perform so much anymore. If a composer asks me to play a drum or something together mm-hmm. with the voice, I'm happy to do that. Helmut has asked me to do it in one piece from Heiner in his orchestra piece. I play two snares and two cymbals to add a semi-chaotic mm-hmm. sound to his piece that the normal percussion session can't really get. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm good at. And I love doing that, but my old drumming style was so highly virtuosic by the end. Mm-hmm. That if I wasn't playing every day, I mean, I would lose mm-hmm. My ability. Mm-hmm. I lost my ability. I mean, truthfully, 10 years, I stopped playing 10 years ago, 11 years ago, the drum collection. And if I sit down again and try to do it, I feel like my whole body is like saying, whoa, what's going on? Mm-hmm. I mean, David, don't you remember what it was like? Yeah, I remember, but I can't do it anymore. Oh my God, you know? It's like going back into history. I've changed. In a good way for myself. I believe musically I've expanded my ideas mm-hmm. and my opportunities to play. As I moved away from the drums, what happened was I moved out into the room. So the room of a singer, the room of a performer is bigger mm-hmm. than a drum set. You know, as someone who's in operas and music theater, you know, the room is a wonderful thing, you know.
For me, it's now also interesting that you develop things from the drumming. But, I mean, you know that when people learn, like, a tabla playing or something in ear, they first, like, speak it and then they kind of play it or do it with each other. Or there was also this kind of rhythm technique mm-hmm. called tacatina. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
You know that.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done a few tacatina sessions and it really helped me to internalize the rhythm. So it's still fascinating for me that you go the other way around.
I actually went the other way. And in almost every way, that's a characteristic of my life. For one reason or another, I almost always went the opposite way.
Okay. It's very fascinating that it works so well. I mean,
it works for me, and I'm glad, you know.
Yes.
Like, for example, my singing came from my drumming as an abstract sound development, not as a way to echo a system.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't going paradiddle, 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 double stroke, double stroke. I wasn't doing the mm-hmm. the learning system mm-hmm, of mm-hmm. the drums.
Mm-hmm.
I was trying to take it into a different dimension, my voice and my drums together. So I was always not using the traditional system. The drums have a traditional system. I learned somewhat traditionally, and I was always fighting mm-hmm. against it, and pretty mm-hmm. soon I broke out of it my own way. And in fact, I learned for 1 year, I studied South Indian mridangam drum.
Okay.
And I learned a little bit of taragiddittum, takataragiddittum, takataragiddittum, a little bit of the system. I loved the system,
uh-huh.
but it was not it didn't, I loved it as a entity, as a kind of an alien, beautiful planet
mm-hmm.
that I would never be able to live on.
Okay.
You know?
So you also give workshops and you're the director of Institute for Living Voice. Mm-hmm. So what can I expect if I come there and I want to work with you? What kind of lessons will I get?
Well, Irene, first of all, you don't need them. But second of all, you understand that for me, workshops were a way to open or expand the universe that was able to listen to my music or not just my music, but the world of music I was into. So I did not and do not offer anyone a system, a style of singing. I more offer a style of thinking about sound creation through the voice in terms mm-hmm. of voice workshops. So how does a person learn to utilize their mind as powerfully as they can as a performer, as a singer? How do you take in information as a performer? How do you output immediately without having to think about it, without having to wonder what to do? How do you use your memory? How do you activate all the things you know? If the director of an opera says, I want you to tell a story, and you say, what kind of a story? He says, come on, make up your own story. Just tell it right now. So these kinds of things, mm-hmm. how do I do this? How do I learn to use everything I have, the incredible experience that each person has in their mind of their whole life waiting to be rearranged and reused? This is what I try to activate as a workshop teacher. Of course, I'm interested in the idea of voice solos, of making the most gorgeous, amazing, unexpected shape with your voice that could be called a melody or could be called a moment of sound, personal sound, you know. I'm very interested in that, and I'm interested in the interaction of people together. I'm mm-hmm. interested in the duo format, especially. Duos I find to be very powerful activities, you know. They generate a lot of not just back and forth, but a lot of unpredictability. It's surprising energy mm-hmm. of what's happening now with mm-hmm. the duo. So I try to also put people in situations where I say to them, you're going to be surprised. That's what we do here. And use the surprise, love the surprise, live with the surprise, take it and run with it. Mm-hmm. That's the best thing in the world. Take it and go it and develop it yourself. And I try to make workshop exercises. I've developed a number over the years that give mm-hmm. People in my classes a chance to do this. And at the end of it, I don't expect anyone to sound like me. I hope they mm-hmm. don't sound like mm-hmm. me. That would be boring if they sounded, or they can take anything they want from my technique or my abilities. That's fine. They can use it. I also like to learn sounds from the people who come to my mm-hmm. workshops. I speak specifically to people about the individuality of the human body, that the body forms the voice. Mm-hmm. I don't see it the other way around. Well, the voice can form the body somewhat, but in generally speaking, the mm-hmm. body mm-hmm. forms the voice, and everyone is unique. Everybody is different. And I want to know how your body works. I want to know how that body mm-hmm. works. I want to know what is happening when this person sings or talks, what it feels like mm-hmm. inside. You know, I'll never be there in your throat, in between your vocal cords, and I'll never be there, but I want to be able to say, what's happening? Can I feel that physically? Mm-hmm. This is a tremendous exploration mm-hmm. work to find out what it feels like. You know, and I really try to focus people on this, and this is a very difficult thing for most people to think about. They don't think about, most students or most learning people don't think about what others are doing. They think about themselves mostly, you know. So I find that to open up to the information coming from outside sources is a good thing.
But you're still teaching, so if somebody wants to contact you, they could.
Yeah,
do
sure.
Through
I'm still teaching.
The,
I still
the
teach.
Internet,
yeah,
the website,
I do
everything
my,
is on there.
I do my own. I give private lessons, and the Institute for Living Voice, which I founded almost 20 years ago, mm-hmm. has periodic meetings. We not so much now as before, but I want to just say something funny about the Institute for Living Voice. Mm-hmm. You know, if you remember what I said about me always fighting against every system, the Institute for Living Voice is also a fight against every system, because there is no institute. Mm-hmm. It's only a word.
Okay.
And in Germany, and in Europe in general, but in Germany, they love the word institute.
Yes, it sounds
you find
very
it.
Established.
It's a very established word.
Cool.
You know, the Institute for Living Voice, we have no house. We have no building. We have no fixed curriculum. We have no fixed teachers. We have no place we go to each time. We change every time we work. We have no paper where we say, boom, here's your stamp. You are now an official graduate of the Institute for Living Voice. But we will make one for you if you say you want one.
Okay.
So in some way, the Institute for Living Voice was for me a wonderful cosmic joke that I made, a beautiful mm-hmm. joke. The joke, the game of singing. Mm-hmm. So we can play the game of singing like a conservatory mm-hmm. plays the game of singing. We have no real power, but we don't need the real power. We bring people together and we generate our own power mm-hmm. that way. And that was the desire, to bring singers, wonderful singers, teachers together, and participants, students who want to work with these people on a very, very intimate basis outside of the conservatory, not in the regular system where they have to get a grade or a number or a certificate, and say, do here, you come here to do what you love. That's what I always say to people. If you're here, you're here because you love it. That's the only reason to be here. Otherwise, don't bother me, you know?
So since you're doing so many different things, teaching, singing a lot, traveling, what is your approach to time management? And do you have any advice for us? Or do you have rituals? How do you do that?
Time management, Irene, is a gigantic question. And it also has to do with the time of life that you're in, you know? So when you're, I mean, I'm no expert. Hey, everything I say is not like I know everything, but just my own experience, okay?
Certainly.
When you're between the ages of 17 and 30, basically you don't think about time management. You go right ahead and you do the things that feel good and the things that make sense and the things that you have to do and want to do and must do and need to do, right? And then at a certain point after that, you begin to reflect. Can I keep on doing this much? Yes or no? What do I cut out? What's important to me? And then if you become a performer living a singing, performing career, you have to say, how can I maintain my health and my energy? A, physical health, physical energy, and how can I maintain my mental health?
Yes,
the process is really mentally draining. The professional life is not simple, you know, because we accept, without thinking, without really thinking about it, you and I, we accept the job that's given to us, which is to be great when we're on stage. That's our job.
Yes.
We accept that as the given. But it's hard work. It's hard to be great every night, every moment, every performance. It's not easy. And the wish to be great is not always the success. And therefore, I, for example, other musicians I know, can become and do become very self-critical. What am I doing? Is it working? How do I make it better? Oh my God, that concert 2 nights ago was terrible. I don't ever want to do that again. Oh, that was fantastic. How can I reach that point again, you know? And you begin to wonder, what should I do? What should I do? What should I do? And then you come close to a kind of mental breakdown, or not a breakdown, more of a mental, like you're in a circle and you can't, a trap, you know? Because part of the power of performing as a musician and as a singer is, as I said before, this timelessness where you are working in a way that brings people into a unknown field where you're not looking at your watch, you're not thinking about dinner, you're all experiencing this moment that's not it's not so mystical, but you're experiencing the moment together, and that has nothing to do with criticism. Nothing to do with self-criticism or good or bad. It's this, what we strive for, what we wish for, you know, in our performance. So the fight between analysis and self-critique and these beautiful moments of being as incredible as you can be and just doing your most beautiful self, these are contradictions. It's a contradiction, and it's a friction. And this friction makes people crazy. And when you do it for 20 years, it gets crazy in the sense that you have to decide, am I being good to myself? Am I taking enough time off? Am I giving myself creative opportunities? Am I taking too much work on? Am I working with the right people? You have to begin to ask questions so that there is place, there are places for you to have this experience. And not only you are a great professional doing the great perfect job, which can't really be done all the time anyhow. So time management, it changes over every 10 years of your life. I think it changes. And if I had any advice at all, I would say to people as a singer or say as a performer, okay, vary your experiences regularly. So in other words, there was a time in my life when I was only doing solos, almost only. So 40 solos a year, 1 hour of solo performance, 40 times, like once a week, 1 hour of solo performance. And after 2 years, I was becoming really a maniac. I mean, because I was so involved in my own mind, in my own brain, I was really strange, you know? And then I began to need other people, to work with other people, to work in a duo, to be part of an ensemble, to even to be quasi director of a small performance, to watch other people and to say, try this, try that, mm-hmm. to try to vary my experiences so that I could give myself more input mm-hmm. and not always have to output. Mm-hmm. To have to output all the time is hard. So okay. give yourself this varying experience. I'm sure everyone knows this in some part of them, that they can get more pleasure. And pleasure is part of what we do. We need to have pleasure to give pleasure, mm-hmm. I think.
Great. What are you thankful for today?
I am thankful I've had my whole life a chance to do almost exactly what I wanted to do. I've had loving people to support that chance. And I've met colleagues and friends who gave me support and love and a challenge to do that, and asked me critical questions, creative questions that helped me, you know, along the way. I'm incredibly grateful for that and thankful for that, you know, and that the world, this crazy world we have, allows and someone, people like me and other people, to do what we love, mm-hmm. and we can earn a living, we can survive, we can be healthy, we can play in some way. I describe it as playing the best game of the world. It's the game of so homo ludus, the game of human, to be a human, to play the game, and to be creative, to be loving, to be weird, to be funny, to be sorry, to be angry, to be beautiful, to be ugly, to be all of these things, you know, and to make jokes and to surprise through performance, through voice, through contact with people. I've had this chance since I was 22 years old, and I'm grateful that I can still do it, you know. Mm-hmm.
Who or what has played the greatest role in shaping you, and what inspires you?
I mentioned earlier John Coltrane, and I do have to come back to him, because his music came into a point in my life when I was most open for emotional change, when I did not know how deep you could go emotionally into music, when music was more of a surface a technique kind of thing. And listening to Coltrane's music at the end of his life brought me to that awareness that the power is there. The power of music is waiting to be taken. Everyone can take the power if you focus mm-hmm. strong enough. And so that really affected me. The second person, strangely enough, was Johann Sebastian Bach.
Oh.
Yeah. Now, not many people would imagine that Coltrane and Bach together, but for me, they're the perfect duo. Mm-hmm. For me, Bach is the example, or is the statement of the necessity of every note, that every note needs every other note. Mm-hmm. Every tone needs the next tone. There is no extraneous, there is no sound that is not needed or necessary. They all form to make this gorgeous sound, music. And that is one of the goals I always had, and it's an unreachable goal in some way, to have every note be necessary. A necessary music. Mm-hmm. It cannot be any other way. That came to me from listening to Bach. And it was so important to me that I taught myself how to play flute so I could play the flute sonatas from Bach, and then I made a flute quartet, and I transcribed the Kunst der Fuge so I could try to play the Art of the Fugue, mm-hmm. because it was so clear to me that everything was necessary, as was with Coltrane, everything necessary in a very different emotional mm-hmm. field, you know, a different cultural field. So these two were, for me, the power mm-hmm. centers of my, I wouldn't use the word spiritual, but they had energy, power, and meaning, deep meaning for me. And since then, I've been influenced by many rock singers, so like James Brown and Aretha Franklin, and also affected by experimental singers like Diamanda Galas. Mm-hmm. And I got to know Meredith Monk when I found out all she was doing. And sadly enough, I never met Dimitrios Stratos, who I very much fell in love with his work after he was no longer here. So I began to listen, of course, to many other things, but that was the early influence. Mm.
And what does success mean for you?
In some way, Irene, there is no such thing as success for me. Success if you say there is success, that means that you close your eyes and you imagine, oh, I'm standing on the platform of success. Here I am. I've reached it. Mm-hmm. But when I close my eyes, I don't see any platform. I see only kind of a extending. If I close my eyes and have a vision of work and life, I see an extending landscape going outward and onward. And every there's a forest, there's a glade, there's a mountain, there's a field, there's a small town, there's a village, there's a cafe, there's a gigantic storm, in each of these places, you can have what we could call a success. You can have a moment that you are incredibly happy about that confirms what you believe. I mean, for me, success is a confirmation of what you believe in a certain way, that the world says, yeah, or an imaginary hand comes down from the universe and touches you on the shoulder and says, exactly. Mm-hmm. That is what I think of as success. Everything else is luck and business and who you know mm-hmm. in some way, you know?
What drives you forward? Do you have a vision?
Well, you know, okay, I'm 70 years old now, so things change. When I was 20, my vision was, I know the truth, and I want to show everybody the truth. I think my music is touching the truth, and I want to show it, and I'm going to show it to everybody. I was somewhat egotistical, or I was somewhat self-concerned, and I had a strong idea, and I wanted to make it happen. Mm-hmm. And that pushed me for many years. That was the drive that I had. And then at a certain point, I said to myself, geez, David, you don't really look at all these people around you doing all this stuff. You don't know anything. I mean, you have a lot of ideas, but you don't know anything for sure, you know? So use in a good way, take part of with the people that you are around you and enjoy and work with this energy to help you mm-hmm. go further, you know? So now my drive and my desire is to have a chance to keep on going, to keep on doing what I do, because it's not so simple. As one gets older, one's willingness to trot around the world gets less and less. One's desire to wait in airports diminishes. Mm-hmm. One's wish to sit in a very ugly little concrete dressing room waiting to go on and be great gets less. Mm-hmm. One's desire to be good does not get less. So things go through changes, and I'm glad and wishing I still have the opportunity mm-hmm. to sing, that my friends and future colleagues will look at me as willing and open to change and say, David, try this, mm-hmm. David, try that, because I need other people to tell me that. I can't do it all myself, you know?
Well, we're already at the last question.
Oh!
Which tip would you like to give young artists?
Now, as an old hippie, and I was actually sort of a hippie way back when, I read a book in college called, what was it called? It was by a writer named Carlos Castaneda, and it was about a mystical journey in Mexico. And the journey was to find a shaman in Mexico who was able to do all these magical things and to help you find your inner spirit. And as I was reading this book when I was 20 years old, I was very excited to think about that such a thing existed. Mm-hmm. But then came one sentence near the end of the book when the shaman was asked by this guy, what should I do with my life? And the shaman said, always take the path with heart. And this became very important to me, this concept. Not that I can do it, not that it's easy to do or you can perfectly do it, but to take the path with your heart, with your feeling, with your love, with your desire. But desire is dangerous because desire is connected to ego, and you know, desire is connected with power. And so I guess I mean the path with heart, encompassing all the things you care about, you know, this is your goal, but whatever your path is, you as an artist, if it's to be an incredible opera singer on the stage, to be a director, to be the most amazing drummer or composer or whatever, do it with your love, do it with the most heart you can. That's my advice.
Well, I thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure. And you're very wise, I must say.
Oh, I'm a wise guy. I wish I could be as wise as I can talk.
And thank you for taking the time with me.
My thanks to you, Irene.
This was the interview with David Moss. I hope that you could take something with you, that it inspired you. And you know, I'm always open for your ideas, suggestions. You can write me anytime through Facebook or email. Thank you very much that you tuned in with me today. I really hope that you liked it and it inspired you. And I would be very, very happy if you could tell your friends and colleagues about this podcast. Thank you very much. I wish you all the best. Live your music, live your life, and see you next time. Yours, Irene.